Support for WPR comes from the Medical College of Wisconsin, Central Wisconsin campus, bringing the first medical school to the region to help ensure generation after generation of Wisconsinites have access to personalized care right here at home.
Today's program was originally broadcast on January 28, 2016. We will not be taking calls today. Enjoy the show.
Fasten your seatbelt, turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. There are thousands of white crosses that stretch across the Netherlands American Cemetery. And one of them bears the name of Wayne C. Clark, a man who grew up in central Wisconsin, who left for the war in Europe at the age of 25, leaving behind a wife and four children in the city of Wausau, and a man who was shot and killed by a sniper in the final days of that war. I'm Glenn Moberg, and today on Route 51, we look into the mystery of Wayne Clark, who he was, how he came to make that ultimate sacrifice, and how his sacrifice was multiplied by its effect on his wife and his children. As we welcome USA Today Network Wisconsin reporter Keith Uhlig to talk about his provocative series, Finding Private Clark, which has appeared online and in the pages of the Wausau Daily Herald, the Marshfield News Herald, the Stevens Point Journal, and the Wisconsin Rapids Daily Tribune. We will also hear from Wayne Clark's son, Sid Clark, now 74 years old, about how Finding Private Clark is also the story of loved ones struggling to find themselves. Perhaps you've been touched by this series of stories. Maybe you know someone or knew somebody who served in World War II or in any of the wars that followed, somebody who made that ultimate sacrifice, or perhaps, as in this story, it is still a mystery, a loved one that you never knew and whose absence shaped your life. Give us a call at 1-800-780-9742. The number again is 1-800-780-9742. Or you can put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page, and I will read it live on the air. Keith Uhlig, who was Private Wayne Clark?
Well, that's a difficult question. I think he was a really resilient man, a man who was mature beyond his years. He struggled as a teenager through depression. His parents were divorced. His father was an alcoholic. He married in 1940, about 4 years before he was drafted into the Army. It's hard for me to answer because I have just pieces of him, letters that he wrote home.
And that's part of the mystery, isn't it?
That's part of what spurred me to delve into this deeper and deeper, as deep as I can go.
Clark served in Company B, 354th Infantry Regiment, 89th Division in Patton's 3rd Army. That was the fighting force that liberated Europe and was memorialized in the movie Patton. So this man saw some action.
He saw short periods of action at the end of the war. They were the 89th Division was known as the Rolling W, or also Patton's Spear Tip. And they were really only in action for a few months, but it was an intense thing, crossing the Rhine, piercing into Germany, that sort of thing.
When and how was Private Clark killed?
It was April 9th, 1945. He was in a battle near Krawinkel, Germany. I believe that's in the central part of Germany. It was a sort of a chaotic battle near the end of the war. Some Germans were just surrendering en masse. Others were fighting hard as a last desperate attempt. And as far as I know, that there was a machine gun placement. His unit was part of a effort to take out that machine gun placement.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that machine gun actually was used as a lure to lure men in, and then he was shot by a sniper.
Did he win any medals or citations for his service?
He received a Purple Heart.
And he's 25 years old. He has a wife and four children. How does a man like that end up being drafted?
That was one of the things that I – that was one of the mysteries when I first started. I'm going, well, he wouldn't have been drafted. From my understanding, and it's limited at this point, is that, you know, we'd been fighting the war for a long time by this time, and we were running out of people. And it was gradually older men were being drafted, fathers were being drafted. He was a truck driver at the time, and that wasn't considered a career that was crucial to the war effort. So he was drafted.
When did your first article on Private Clark appear?
That would have been late May of 2015. It stemmed from a phone call that I received from a man named Joe Winkins. Joe's Dutch. He's part of a group that's called Foundation United Adopters American War Graves. This is a longstanding Dutch nonprofit that adopts graves, so to speak, in the Netherlands American Cemetery. And what Joe and I'm not sure how many, hundreds, maybe thousands of other Dutch people do is during special holidays, they put flowers on the graves. They make sure that grave is well taken care of. The overall maintenance and running of the cemetery is done by the United States, but they take it that next step. Their intent is that they understand what it means to be liberated, and they want to make sure that the sacrifices that those soldiers made are never forgotten.
So Joe Winkins was taking care of this gravesite, just one white cross among how many, hundreds, thousands of white crosses in that cemetery?
8,300.
8,300.
About.
And he never knew who Private Clark was.
Right.
And that's why he called you.
Right. So he knew a little bit. He got some documentation from the U.S. military. He knew, about the battle. He knew about the things that Wayne had when he was killed. He knew that he was born in Marathon County. But that's about it. He didn't know whether there was any family available, and he had been doing this for about 10 years.
So you get this phone call, and in that first article you write, "When Winkins was speaking to me from Northern Europe, goosebumps crawled up my arms. That happens sometimes when I know I'm onto a terrific story." What makes this story terrific? There are a lot of people in that cemetery.
I think every story of every man in that cemetery is a terrific story. And one of the things this organization does is try to preserve those stories as best they can. What happened with me is I think I was particularly receptive to that phone call. I had covered about a month earlier the Never Forgotten Honor Flight, which takes World War II, Korean, and Vietnam War veterans to Washington, D.C., to see the memorials there. And it was during that time that you just have time to think and see these men and understand what it took. And they were lucky.
I had the privilege of going on one of those flights too, and you can't say enough about Jim Campbell and the other people who have organized them, because hundreds upon hundreds of World War II veterans are finally appreciated and finally have a chance to see the memorials that were put up in their honor.
Absolutely. There's influence of Jim and Mike Thompson, the other their influence is on this, because I was receptive to Joe. And because Joe didn't know anything, and I just did some preliminary phone calls. Wayne Clark. I just started calling Clarks in the phone book in Wausau. And I just felt I don't want Wayne Clark, whoever he is, to be forgotten, to be anonymous. And that started it all.
And then your most recent article appeared just a couple of days ago, just a few days ago. And you write about the Wreaths of Honor. And you share a letter from David Hahn of Pittsville. He's a member of the American Legion Writers District 8, which put wreaths on the graves of veterans. So here we've come full circle. And this is what I found interesting. David included a quote by Pierre Clisson: "To be killed in a war is not the worst that can happen. To be lost is not the worst that can happen. To be forgotten is the worst."
It was really... So I got goosebumps right now. Even when I read that, I got goosebumps, because that encapsulate at least my initial – that encapsulates my initial drive to find out more. And I thought the thing about writing for a newspaper is, you know, it's history as it happens. But I felt also that, you know, what we write gets preserved somehow or another, like at historical societies and so on and so forth. And I thought, at least this will – Wayne will be preserved. His memory will be preserved.
Well, you've written lots of articles and blogs in the past year. I haven't kept track of the number.
I don't know the number either. It's been an average of one a week or a little less.
What reaction have you been getting from your readers?
Mostly positive reaction. Those initial stories really were attention grabbers. It captured people's curiosity, I think, and that sense of mystery was a big deal. And that ran in papers across the state, and the Star Tribune picked up on it, the Associated Press. And so I started getting a lot of emails and help finding out. And then as I've progressed and found out more and sort of it's been a shotgun approach. You know, I find out something, I just put it in the blog.
Is that how you ended up getting in touch with Leah Woods?
Yeah.
Who is Wayne Clark's daughter and also Sid Clark, who we're going to hear from later in the show.
Yes. That initial story, Joe called the Daily Herald because he thought a story would open the doors. And he was right. Immediately, people started calling. And it was – I think Leah actually contacted me, because my phone number is on the stories, and then she called me.
And she wrote or she said to you, and you wrote in your blog, quoting her, "My grandparents, everybody in our family, nobody ever talked about him. We hear of men who came back from the war, Keith, who don't talk about what they went through. And then there are men like Private Clark who can't talk to us."
Yeah, I think Clark's loss – Clark was a linchpin or a leader, the center of that family. I'm learning more and more. And his loss, I think, really put people on a shaky ground. And I think most everybody in his family did the best they could in moving forward, but they did not confront the pain. And I think that's typical of that generation.
Leah's visited her father's grave twice now, and she said, "I was just amazed at all the white grave markers and probably how much I missed in my life."
Yeah. Yeah, it's talking both to Leah and Sid is a difficult thing. And so the initial impetus of the story was to find out about Wayne. Then it became more about the cost of war.
The cost of war and how when you lose the linchpin of an entire family, it's not just Wayne Clark who suffers.
No, the sacrifices were made by his mother, by his sister, by his children.
You have a photo that you shared of Wayne Clark and Beatrice Babs McCable on their wedding day on May 12, 1940 in Shawano. Mm-hmm. And you write in that article, maybe it's reading too much into the photo, but it seems you can see a mixture of emotions brewing under the surface, hope and fear, confidence and unease.
Yeah. Remember, they're just coming out of the Depression. These people, the Clarks, were not a family that had many financial resources. They struggled through the Depression before the Depression. And my sense is that in 1940 – I'm not sure exactly when Wayne started driving truck. He was, according to the records that I have, he was a truck driver when he was drafted at a firm in Clintonville. I'm not exactly sure how long he had that job. I think he moved from job to job through the Depression.
And they were young. He was 21. She was 19.
Right.
And were they Catholic? They were Irish.
I don't know. I believe so. I'm not quite sure about their
religion. But they ended up having four children, mm-hmm. and they were living on Grand Avenue in Wausau.
Well, there's a bit of mystery there. So for a while, Wayne was living with Babs' family in Shawano. I'm not sure. So at the time of his death, according to newspaper accounts, his sister Delia, his brother-in-law Lawrence, Delia's Lawrence Green was in the military too. Delia and Babs were living on Grand Avenue in Wausau. Nobody in the family can remember why, what they did. And it seems to be a strange thing, and I've never been able to kind of figure out why they were living in Wausau.
But that's where Babs and Delia and the kids were.
When he died.
When that article appeared in the Record Herald that Wayne had been killed. Do you have any idea how they reacted?
I can only imagine. I know that Babs had to have been in shock. She was ill-equipped to deal with that loss. And, you know, as we'll discuss later, she eventually gave up the care of her children.
What made her do that? How can you give up your four children and just disappear?
I think there's a lot of factors involved in that. I don't know. Leah and Sid don't know. Leah asked her mother that when they were adults, and Babs told her she felt it was the best thing.
And in 1972, Leah tried to commit suicide, and you talked to her about that.
She talked to me about that. And what you'll hear when you talk with Sid is the fact that they were cared for, and they truly appreciate the care that they had from Delia, their aunt, and Lawrence, their uncle. But they never felt a part of that family, and they never felt truly loved. And it probably is a big part of Babs giving up the care.
And you don't know how much of that was the case or how much of that is their perceptions because of the trauma they've gone through, losing their
– And they were children.
Their father, losing their mother
at
a very young age. And it was a tough life for those kids growing up with Lawrence and Delia on a farm near Stevens Point.
Correct. Yeah.
What happened to the other two kids, David and Arletta?
I don't know much about them. David died – I'm not exactly sure, 80s or 90s. He was in his 50s or 60s. Sid told me he was not in good health. He didn't have a happy life. He was dealing with smoking and he said drinking. The youngest daughter, Arletta, is living. I'm not quite sure where she's at. I've contacted her and she declined to participate. And so I've done my best to sort of respect that yearning for privacy.
And there were other emotional problems in the family's history that go back further than that. In the midst of the Great Depression, Wayne's father, Clifford Clark, succumbs to alcoholism, and he was eventually committed as an inmate patient at Winnebago State Hospital.
Yeah, he may have been a veteran. He also was at the King Veterans Home. I'm assuming that because he lived there, he was a veteran. Some of the people who have helped me found records of his draft registration from World War I. I don't know whether he actually served in the Army or not, but I wonder about that.
You know, Keith, we often try to glorify the people who came out of the Depression and won World War II. We call them the greatest generation. But what I'm gleaning from your story is that beneath all of that mythology, we're talking about real people with problems just like people have today, just like you and me.
Yeah, I think sometimes we do tend to mythologize and, you know, create this sort of blanket platitude of they got the job done. They did, you know. They are Wayne's resilience in face of staggering difficulties is amazing. I mean, I can't say. Like, I really wanted to find out, you know, did he have a sense of humor? Was he a happy person? I don't know that, but just reading between the lines and maybe reading a bit too much into pictures and tone of letters.
And those few letters that he sent.
Yeah, the few letters, they're very straightforward, very matter of fact, and I get a sense of a really practical person.
We're going to take a short break. We're talking to USA Today Network Wisconsin reporter Keith Ulig about a series of articles and blogs that have appeared online and in the pages of the Wausau Daily Herald and the other Gannett newspapers in central Wisconsin. It's called Finding Private Clark. When we return, we will hear from Private Wayne Clark's now 74-year-old son, Sid, who has no memories of his father but whose life was changed by his service and his death. I'm Glenn Moberg. You can give us a call at 1-800-780-9742 if you'd like to join the conversation. The number again is 1-800-780-9742, or you can put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page, and I'll read it live on the air. Here's General Patton, who Private Clark served under, talking about the Third Army and its service in Europe during World War II.
We passed over a destroyed land. Utterly destroyed. You who have not seen it do not know what hell looks like from the top. That's what Germany looks like. That Austria looks like. That's what any place that the 8th Air Force and the 3rd Army worked on looks like. The trail of the 3rd Army and the 19th Tactical Air Command and the 8th Air Force is marked by more than 40,000 white crosses, 40,000 dead Americans.
Thank you to the business sponsors who help support WPR programs, including Steepenbrew, Marcus Center for the Performing Arts, and The Bold Company. Play a role in the success of WPR. Become a business sponsor. Go to WPR.org/sponsor.
Support also comes from attorneys Sturgill and Long, serving the legal needs of the elderly and their families throughout Wisconsin and the Michigan Upper Peninsula. Information is at 888-613-0600.
Wisconsin Public Radio is proud to sponsor the 7th Annual Bluegrass in the Pines Bluegrass Festival, August 25th through the 27th at Rosholt Fair Park in Rosholt. Hosted by Art Stevenson and Highwater, this three-day event will also feature Rob Lombard and friends, the Poe Ramblin' Boys, Slompy Joe, and many more of the country's best bluegrass acts. More information at WPR.org/central.
I'm living in Sawmill Town. I'm working till the sun goes down.
Every Friday, we discuss and debate the top political news each week with two guests from different perspectives during our Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll join in with your questions and views, too, on the issues that matter most to you during the Week in Review, Friday mornings at 8, rebroadcast Friday nights at 9, here on the Ideas Network.
Don't sit under the apple tree with anyone else but me. Anyone else but me. Anyone else but me. No, no. With anyone else but me, till I come marching home.
Those are the Andrews sisters singing the World War II anthem for those who served overseas and those who were left behind. Don't sit under the apple tree with anyone else but me until I come marching home. Now, the Andrews sisters had another song, Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy of Company B. And today on Route 51, we're talking about a central Wisconsin man, Wayne Clark, who served in Company B, 354th Infantry Regiment, 89th Division in Patton's 3rd Army, the fighting force that liberated Europe. And Wayne Clark, like many fighting men, left behind a wife, Beatrice or Babs, and four kids, Sid, Leah, David, and Arletta, who were living in Wausau when they got the word that Private Clark had been killed in the final days of the war. We're talking today with USA Today Network Wisconsin reporter Keith Ulig about a series of articles and blogs that have appeared online and in the pages of the Wausau Daily Herald called Finding Private Clark. I'm Glenn Moberg. We'd like to hear from you. Give us a call at 1-800-780-9742. If you'd like to join the conversation, that's 1-800-780-9742. Or you can put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page. I'll read it live on the air. And if you go to our Facebook page, you will find a link to Keith Ulig's Finding Private Clark blog. Keith, as we discussed, Wayne Clark's death, like the deaths of many American soldiers, had a profound effect on the family members who were left behind.
It certainly did. I was just thinking as you were speaking about this, his mother, her name was Patsy Shobuti. She lived in Mozenie at the time. She didn't believe that he had been killed. I'm not sure how long until she finally accepted the reality. She felt that he was still alive.
And you wrote a couple of articles about Sid and Leah growing up without a father and a mother, as it turned out. You write that the two believe that Babs, Wayne's wife, had an emotional and mental breakdown after Wayne's death, that the German sniper, in essence, not only took Wayne's life, took the father but also took the mother away from these children.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, half a world away, you know, the reverberation of that one shot.
And you tell Sid's story growing up without a dad about his decision to run away from the home of his adoptive parents, Delia and Lawrence Green. And you quote him as saying, "I don't remember being a kid."
He felt that it was a hard life. You'll hear him talk about this working on a farm, and you just felt that he needed to be an adult, be on his own from early on.
And he ended up leaving home, running away from home at the age of 16. He lived out of his car, and he ended up joining the service himself. And he said one of the reasons he did that is because the father he never knew
he had felt been that in the was service. Important. Yeah. He knew his father did it, and he felt that he should do that too.
And he became a systems analyst for a paper company, so he led a productive life and later moved to Arkansas, and that's where we caught up with him for an interview that we recorded yesterday. Here's Private Wayne Clark's son, Sid Clark, who has no memories of his father.
Well, I don't ever recall seeing my father. I was 4 years old when he died. And I have no recollection at all of my father or seeing a man at all, you know, at that age. So,
you were a toddler. You were very young. Do you remember that terrible day that your mother saw the article in the Record Herald saying that he'd been killed?
I don't recall that. Because I think when my mother found that out, I believe she left. That's my understanding. All right. And probably because she was so distraught that she couldn't deal with it, you know. I don't remember that day at all, you know, no recollection of that.
Keith Ulig, you write in your blog that you believe and some family members believe that she had a mental breakdown.
Yeah, Sid, I think you told me that you felt that she just was ill-equipped to deal with the tragedy of losing your father, but then dealing with four children.
That would my recollection later on, because when she left, I didn't see her for a long time. And I remember that she would come in once in a while. This lady would come in, and I would suspect that I was a teenager before I even realized that that was my mother. So I never really had a relationship with my mother. She was gone.
So in a sense, you not only lost your father, you lost your mother in this situation too.
That is correct.
This had to be tough not only on you, but also your siblings. Your mom gave up all of her own children to be raised by your dad's sister, Delia Green, and her husband, Lawrence.
That is correct. Now, I think there was a time in there, I have a vague memory of being someplace, I thought that it was an orphanage, all right? I remember being in a room with a lot of kids, and I think that was in an orphanage, or at least was under probably the Department of Human Services for a while, till my aunt took the four kids.
How old would you have been when you had that memory? Just give me a ballpark figure for how old you think.
I'm going to say I would have been between, you know, in the 4 to 5 range, okay? I remember it's when I was 6, I was with my aunt. I remember that because, you know, that's when I started first grade, and we were with my aunt at that time.
What was life like for you growing up in Stevens Point?
My first recollection was we lived in a house that was a two-story house that had a wood stove, you know, and then we moved to the farm, and of course my growing up years were, you know, I don't remember doing the kind of things when I was younger that kids typically do now, I mean, or at least did a few years ago. I don't remember playing games, you know, like that. My recollection is we always had something to do, and of course I was the oldest of all the kids, including my aunt's children, you know, her birth children. So I was out, you know, working on the farm, you know, doing what I could do at that particular age.
Do you feel you had any kind of a childhood, as most people understand that term?
I don't recall having a childhood, no.
Keith, you write that his Uncle Lawrence was a very quiet individual.
That's how it was how he was described to me. He was a veteran himself. He was a member of he was a paratrooper.
Yes, that is correct. I knew that when I was growing up that he was a paratrooper because he, you know, there was some talk about that. But he received several honors that I never knew about. And he was never, you know, like the kind of things I talked to my kids about. You know, the things that fathers would say, I never heard that from him, you know. Because he was very quiet. And, of course, he was also a truck driver, so he was gone a lot. And he was a hard-working man. I'm not saying that. But, you know, he was not there. As I look at a father image now or a father image that I was, I never saw that with him. But I also never saw that mother image with my aunt. And part of that's probably due to the fact that I was the oldest one of all the siblings, you know.
So a lot of responsibilities were on your shoulders.
Yeah, I didn't look at it at the time because, you know, when you're growing up in the environment that you're in, you just think that's life.
You ran away from home as a young man. Tell us about that. Tell us why you did it.
Well, the day that I ran away, my uncle was home and my aunt was there and I was there. And we went to Stevens Point to get parts for the farm equipment. And we pulled up in front of the store to buy this stuff. And my aunt turned to me, and I remember it like it was yesterday, in an angry voice said, "You stay in the car." And within 10 minutes, I wrote a quick note, and I was gone.
And how old were you, Sid?
I was probably between 16 and 17.
Your sister Leah also suffered because of this situation. She tried to commit suicide in 1972.
Yes, and I didn't realize that until, you know, when Keith started doing this, I found out things about my sister and how bad it was for them when I left. They said it just got worse. Of course, you understand, they probably had the brunt of all this stuff even before I ran away, because my escape was going to the farm, going out to the barn or going out and doing chores. So I wasn't in the house that much, you know. When I finished my chores, I'd come in and take a shower or a bath, and then I'd go to bed, and then I'd get up in the morning and milk cows, and then I'd come in and wash up, and I was going to school. And, of course, when I went to high school, I did play in sports. I went to a small school in Elmond, Wisconsin, and I played all the sports. And I loved football, so I guess I'd been in some of my frustrations. They told me when I was playing that I'd been in some frustrations on the
football field.
So,
did you ever have a chance later in life to talk to your mother Babs about your dad, about Wayne, and about what went through her mind when she felt she had to give you up?
No, I didn't. I never knew her as a mother, and I never knew my aunt as a mother. You know, those kind of things didn't cross my mind.
Sid, what's your reaction to Keith's series, Finding Private Clark? Did you ever think a stranger, a newspaper man, would take this much interest in the father that you never knew?
Well, before it all started, no. I mean, I just didn't give it any thought about any of it. I know my sister had gone over there, and my dad's, you know, to the cemetery, and, you know, and I think she'd been over there a couple of times. I had no interest in going over there. Partly, I guess I don't know how I would deal with it. You know.
Sid, we tend to glorify the men who served in World War II. We call them the greatest generation. Do you think that we have a tendency to kind of mythologize people and not treat the people who served in that war and grew up at that time as ordinary human beings who had problems and some of the same concerns in life that all of us have today?
I think more so today, you know, because if you look at that, you know, and we don't know where the world's going today, but if you look at where the world was headed at that particular time, that probably, to me, was the biggest sacrifice, because if there wouldn't have been the Second World War, if we wouldn't have won that war, you know, well, there wouldn't be any United States, in my opinion. And I think they had the extreme sacrifice, and I look at them all as heroes. I don't know about the generations in the future, but I think that those people were they were willing to go out. They knew they probably wouldn't come back, and you know, we owe a lot to all these people, including the people that are in service today. And I don't know how we can honor them anymore, but you know, I was in the service myself, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't feel I need to be honored, all right? I served because, you know, I wanted to go in because I knew my dad had been in there, you know, even though I didn't know him. And that was one of the reasons. And the other reason is, here I was, a kid that just ran away from home. I had graduated from high school. I didn't know what I wanted to do in life, so I went to service. And I never regret that. But the bottom line now is that more people survive the injuries, but that brings on a whole new set of problems for them. I mean, they have struggles that, you know, and I'm not saying my dad would have survived at all, you know, with his injuries. I don't believe he would have, you know. But there are others that survive now from injuries that back in World War II, they did not survive. So I think it brings on a whole new set of problems, you know. And I think there's a lot more help now for the kids that are left, okay? And I hope that through what Keith is doing, that the people that are out there that are my age and their kids can really understand. I'm sure I'm not the only one, for example, that grew up like this. You know, until all of this came up, I just went on with life. I mean, I thought that's what life was all about, and you just go on, you know. But the one thing I probably didn't have and deal with is any emotions about it. And because I didn't grew up with the affections that typically I would see with my kids or my grandkids, and I got great grandkids now, how precious they are and how much of an impact you can have on them. I probably struggle with that a little bit. I guess the bottom line is, you know what love really is. Anyway.
Sid, thanks so much for spending some time with us. Do you have anything you'd like to say to Keith Uhlig?
Well, I guess thanks. You know, thanks for me and my sisters, but thanks for all those people that are sitting out there that are listening to this that will give them a little help. As I say now, it's really not about me, but it's about help for a lot of people. You know, and I have people call me that have known me in the past, and said, is that you? So anyway, to Keith and everybody that's been involved, I would just say thanks.
Sid, thank you, too.
Thanks for me, and thanks for Leah.
Oh, thank you, Sid.
The words of Sid Clark, the now 74-year-old son of Private Wayne Clark, who died by a sniper's bullet in the final days of World War II, and whose story is now being told in a series of articles named Finding Private Clark that appeared in the Wausau Daily Herald. You'll also find a link to it on the Route 51 Facebook page. All of this thanks to our guest, USA Today Network Wisconsin reporter Keith Uhlig. And again, we would like to hear from you. Maybe you've been touched by this story. Maybe you've got friends or family members who have served and whose service, maybe it's appreciated, maybe not enough. Give us a call at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or you can put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page. Keith, your reaction to that interview with Sid Clark. It was pretty amazing the way he opened up.
Yeah, my reaction is I just feel incredibly honored that they were able to – that they talked to me, shared with me this stuff, him and Leah. And it's a – I don't know. I can't quite put that into words.
Sid said he had no emotions when his mom died. No emotions whatsoever. He didn't feel like she was his mother, and he had no memories of his father.
Yeah, I think the Clarks are a family that move ahead and deal with what is in front of them. I don't think they dwell much. They don't stop and dwell is what I think, but sometimes they do.
A pragmatic person is how you described him. Mm-hmm. And he talks about the strained relationship that he had with his adopted parents, mm-hmm. Lawrence and Delia. But we were talking while we were listening to this, and you mentioned Lawrence went through all kinds of trauma. He stood up at Wayne's wedding. He was Wayne's brother. He lost his brother and then
mm-hmm.
ended up getting his children and never talked about it.
Yeah, I think if I were to make an incredible leap in logic, I would guess that, you know, Lawrence Green was a hero himself. He fought, I believe, with the 82nd Airborne, which meant that he jumped into Europe and almost certainly lost friends in the war and survived. I would guess that there has to be issues of PTSD and that sort of thing. And then
to come back, and he's probably feeling guilty because he's alive and his brother isn't.
I have no idea. Yeah, I have no idea about that, but that's how I would be feeling. And
and we all know people who have fought who do not want to talk about their experiences.
Right.
My father fought in World War II. He was a radio engineer. Behind the lines in Europe, and he never talked about any of his experiences to us.
Did he
never?
Did he do it when he was older?
He was in his 20s.
No, I mean, did he speak about it when he got older?
Not really. No, no. I mean, a little bit here and there.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you'd watch certain movies, World War II movies, and he'd have to get up and get out of the room.
Wow. I have a father-in-law who was a Marine during World War II, my father-in-law, and he was in some of the worst battles in the Pacific. He was a radio op, a signalman too. I don't believe he ever fired his rifle in a battle, but he was in the battles. And he talked to me about this, and he felt it was a matter of luck. Living or dying.
And one of the things Sid said when I asked him that question about the Greatest Generation, he said, no, really they were heroes. If they hadn't won World War II, the United States wouldn't exist. And many of them, like the father that he never knew, went overseas knowing that they might not come back.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I believe, you know, it was like – so you have this world – I tried to put myself in the place, and I can't quite imagine it. I look through the papers. You put yourself in this world, and you understand what's happening, not fully understanding even the evil that was happening. But you felt everybody was doing this. This is my job. This is what we've got to do. Let's get it done with.
And then finally, he mentions the technology that today keeps a lot of soldiers alive who otherwise would have died in battle. And that's created a whole new set of problems. How much we owe those people who came back with injuries and those who served, and then we see the way they're being treated by the screw-ups with the Veterans Administration and Intoma, and it's you know, it's something we need to address.
My viewpoint of that is that underneath this all is and Leah's mentioned this, is that we need to make sure that we support these families. The men, the women, the children who are affected by war.
We're talking today with USA Today Network Wisconsin reporter Keith Ulig about his series, Finding Private Clark. We'd like to hear from you. Give us a call at 1-800-780-9742. When we come back, some final thoughts about Private Clark and the letters he sent back from the battlefield as he served in Patton's Third Army during the final days of World War II.
The storm breaks in full final fury on the German Rhine. Swiftly exploiting successes, three American divisions smash into the battered heart of Cologne. The ancient cathedral looks down through blind, staring eyes upon a great city torn to shreds, smashed into ruins, but still defended by fanatics. Here is the beginning of the vengeance visited on a people who carried terror and destruction to others without reason.
Thank you to the business sponsors who help support WPR programs. D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics, Access Prosthetics, and Gimme Shelter Construction play a huge role in the success of WPR. Your business can too. More information at WPR.org/sponsor. Support also comes from Christine Bremer Moogley of the personal injury law firm Bremer & Trollope, committed to protecting the rights of accident victims throughout Wisconsin. Bremer & Trollope, because the right results matter most. Bremer-law.com.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a proud sponsor of the Riverfront Jazz Festival September 3rd and 4th at Biffner Park in Stevens Point. Central Wisconsin's largest jazz festival, located on the scenic Wisconsin River, hosts a variety of exceptional jazz musicians, including vaudeville influence Patti and the Buttons, saxophonist Benny Golson, the pop jazz performing Joe Palacastro Trio, and more. More information at WPR.org/central.
Get a dose of state politics Monday mornings on the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, and every Monday morning after 7, we review the top issues facing Wisconsin in our state capitol report. Our state government reporter, Sean Johnson, gets us up to speed on the debates taking place in Madison and what your elected representatives are up to on the state capitol report, Monday mornings on the Ideas Network.
We're listening to A String of Pearls by Benny Goodman, a piece of music that Private Wayne Clark probably knew well as it was broadcast on the public airwaves during the World War II years. Private Wayne Clark, born in Mosinee, served in Patton's Third Army during the final days of World War II, killed by a sniper's bullet, leaving behind a wife and four children in Wausau whose lives were changed forever. Now buried in the Netherlands American Cemetery in a grave tended to by a man who never knew him and who called our guest looking for information, Keith Ulig of the Wausau Daily Herald. Keith, Wayne Clark, when he died, had these things in his possession: a cigarette lighter, a wallet, 13 photos, a penknife, a wristwatch, 5 German bills of no monetary value, a handful of French, German, and Belgium coins, and a blood-stained watch strap.
That's according to the U.S. military. That was some of the documents that Joe actually got through the organization that he works with through the Dutch. And it's very matter of fact. You can imagine. So we lost – Americans lost about 600,000 men in battle during World War II. And you think about all the typing, all the administrative, all this paperwork.
You have a handful of letters from him. The earliest one is a 10-year-old child in Mosinee, a typewritten letter to his sister. And he sounds like an ordinary kid about taking fishing lines and fish hooks and going fishing.
He sounded precocious to me, smart. I'm just – I'm thinking at that time, I think that was in the 20s, typewriters were like a rare thing, very expensive, and I don't know how he would have gotten access to that. But and he wrote it as if it were a business letter. I really like that too. Some of the language he used in it was very good.
And then later, serving in Europe, he writes, "I am now in Germany with the Third Army and in combat. We sure got those Heinies on the run, and I sure hope they keep running until they all drown in the sea. I have seen a few good Germans, dead ones, and a lot of prisoners. They do know how to surrender, and I don't think Hitler taught it to them. Well, after all, that's what we want, is to get this war over with."
That's where I think that was his state of mind. I want to just go home. I want to, finish this.
And this was a man, again, who struggled with money, so poor that when he was stationed in the U.S. and got several days off for Christmas, he couldn't afford to hop a train or a bus and head home. Mm-hmm. And he wrote in another one of your letters, "I went to Durham yesterday afternoon. Saw all the Christmas things in the windows, which sure made me lonesome. A man would like to buy lots of things, but this thing called money keeps you from it. Maybe we'll have a little money next Christmas, and maybe it will be more peaceful. Here's hoping I'm out of the Army by then." But he never got out of the Army, and there was never another Christmas for Wayne Clark.
He didn't get to go home for Christmas either. He shipped out to Europe on December 26, 1944, spent time in France. As they prepared, as his division prepared for battle, one of the interesting little side notes is that he was taking a correspondence course on auto mechanics while he was in France in his spare time. I found that to be really interesting.
Wayne's death not only affecting his wife and kids, also affecting his sister Delia, who would break into tears whenever she heard Wayne's favorite song, Danny Boy.
She was had difficulty with raising Wayne's children. She was a very interesting person. She also was very resilient. Later on, earning a degree in social work at age of 54, sort of embracing women's rights and other things along those lines. Really an incredible person.
And probably doing the very best she could under the circumstances.
I can't imagine that she didn't. You know, even Wayne and Leah both say that, you know, they express gratitude for what Lawrence and Delia did for them.
And again, I'm going to end this show with the same question I asked you at the beginning, Keith. Why should we care about Private Wayne Clark? So many died in World War II. What makes him so special that you would devote this series of articles and blogs to this unknown man over the past year?
I think that's a good question, and it's a complicated one, but my answer to that is because he isn't special is why I wanted to do this, because he's normal. He is us. He's every man. You know, he's a guy who is struggling through life and he doing the best he can, and he made the ultimate sacrifice. I think that's the reason why. He's not special, but yet he's incredibly special. Everybody is in some way, but that's where I think where I was coming from on that.
And to end with that quote again by Pierre Clisson, to be killed in a war is not the worst that can happen. To be lost is not the worst that can happen. To be forgotten is the worst.
Thanks.
Keith Ulig, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Glenn.
Our guest today, Keith Ulig, reporter for the Wausau Daily Herald and USA Today Network Wisconsin, and Sid Clark, the son of Wayne Clark. You can find out more by reading Keith Ulig's blog at wausaudailyherald.com/blog/findingprivateclark. Also, a link to that blog on the Route 51 Facebook page. I'm Glenn Moberg. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our on-air producer, Jane Ritger. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Special music today from the movie Patton and by Benny Goodman, the Andrews Sisters, and Glenn Miller. Next week on Route 51, we preview an upcoming program at UW-Marathon County called Baby Business, the Dollars and Cents of Investing in Working Parents. That program is the morning of February 10th. One of our guests will be Rob Grunewald, an economist with the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. Thanks for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin, and until next week, we're heading out of town.